Hey there everybody, you're listening to The Raven's Grove. I'm your host, Dahi, and today, once again, we're going to be diving into the world of music, but more specifically, we're going to be talking about five of the lesser-known musical instruments from around the world. We've got the hurdy-gurdy, the balalaika, the Aztec death whistle, the tobshur, and the morenghur. Now, before I go any further, this episode of The Raven's Grove features the following trigger warnings. We've got death mentions, torture mentions, human sacrifice mentions, so if any of those are in any way an issue for you, please give this episode a miss. Also, I want to make it very clear at the outset, I do not speak Mongolian at all, I speak barely any Russian, and I don't speak any Hungarian or Polish. So if I make any pronunciation mistakes with this episode, that is entirely on me. I would highly recommend that you look up how these words and phrases are meant to be pronounced on your own. So don't take my word for how they're pronounced. I am probably going to pronounce them wrong. I'm going to do my best, but there's very high likelihood I will make a mistake. Anyway, now those are out of the way. Let's get started. So first up, we've got one of my personal favorite musical instruments. We've got the hurdy-gurdy. Now, from a historical point of view, the hurdy-gurdy is actually one of the oldest string musical instruments on the planet, having been in music since at least the Middle Ages. According to Wikipedia, the hurdy-gurdy is generally thought to have originated from fiddles in either Europe or the Middle East, for instance, the rebab instrument, before the 11th century AD, end quote. Now, that's... considering how long musical instruments last, that is an insane feat. The first recorded reference for fiddles in Europe was in the 9th century by the Persian geographer, and I'm probably going to butcher this name, Ibn Quradadbih. Like I said, I don't speak Arabic, so I could easily have got that wrong. Apparently that guy died in 911, not the 911, 911 CE, describing the lira, or lura, as a typical instrument within the Byzantine Empire. One of the earliest forms of the hurdy-gurdy was the organistrum, a large instrument with a guitar-shaped body and a long neck in which the keys were set, covering a wide diatonic octave. I'll be talking more about diatonics later in this episode. The organistrum had one single melody string and two drone strings, which ran over a common bridge, and a relatively small wheel. Due to its size, the organistrum was played by two people, one of whom turned the crank while the other pulled the keys upward. Pulling the keys upward is cumbersome, so only quite slow tunes could be played on the organistrum. One of the earliest visual depictions of the organistrum is from the 12th century Porta da Gloria, the portal of Spain, on the cathedral at Santiago de Compostela, Galicia in Spain. It is a carving of two musicians playing an organistrum. Later, the organistrum was made smaller to let a single player turn both the crank and work the keys. The solo organistrum was known from Spain and France, but was largely replaced by an improved variant known as the sinfonia in the 13th century, a small box-shaped version of the hurdy-gurdy with three strings and a diatonic keyboard. Now, here's where diatonics comes in. Diatonics means it follows a pattern of tone, tone, semitone, tone, 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 semitone. Now, that's pretty standard in music theory. And this is actually quite different to the chromatic pattern, which is where it plays every single note in a scale, be they major, minor, sharps, flats, augmented, or diminished. So, put it this way, if you're playing a regular scale on the guitar or on the piano or whatever musical instrument you're playing, those eight notes in the scale, they will be following the tone, tone, semitone, tone, 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 semitone of the diatonic system. If you're playing every single fret on a guitar or every single key on a keyboard or piano, regardless of whether or not it's meant to be in the scale, then you're playing the chromatic pattern. Anyways, about the same time, a new form of key press from beneath was developed. These keys were much more practical for faster music and easier to handle, and eventually they completely replaced keys pulled up from above. Medieval depictions of the sinfonia show both types of keys. Now, during the Renaissance, the hurdy-gurdy was a very popular instrument, along with the bagpipe, and the characteristic form had a short neck and a boxy body with a curved tail end. It was around this time the buzzing bridges first appeared in illustrations. The buzzing bridge, commonly known as the dog, is an asymmetrical bridge that fits under a drone string on the soundboard. When the wheel is accelerated, one foot of the bridge lifts and the soundboard and vibrates, creating a buzzing sound. The buzzing bridge is actually thought to have been borrowed from the tromba marina, otherwise known as the monochord, a bowed stringed instrument. Now, during the late Renaissance, you had two distinctive shapes of hurdy-gurdies were developing. The first was guitar-shaped, and the second had a rounded lute-type body made of staves. The lute-type body is especially characteristic of French instruments. By the end of the 17th century, changing musical tastes demanded greater polyphonic capabilities than the hurdy-gurdy could offer, and it pushed the instrument to the lower social classes. As a result, they acquired names like the Germans, I'm probably going to butcher this, Bauernlyre, the peasant's lyre, and Bettlerlyre, which is the beggar's lyre. During the 18th century, however, French Rococo taste for rustic diversions brought the hurdy-gurdy back to the attention of the upper classes, where it acquired tremendous popularity among the nobility, with famous composers writing actual works of the hurdy-gurdy, with the most famous of these is Nicolas Chédeville's Il Pastor Fido, published under the name of Antonio Vivaldi. At this time, the most common style of hurdy-gurdy developed, with the six-string Vielle à Roue. This instrument has two melody strings and four drone strings. The drone strings are tuned so that by turning them off and on, the instrument can be played in multiple keys, for instance, C and G or G and D. Now, during this time, the hurdy-gurdy also spread further into Central Europe, where further variations developed in Western Slavic countries, German-speaking areas, and Hungary. Now, like I said, I don't speak Hungarian, and I speak maybe a handful of words in Russian. I don't speak Polish at all, so I am probably going to butcher these pronunciations, but we'll see how it goes. Most types of hurdy-gurdies were essentially extinct by the early 20th century, but a few have survived. The best known are the French Vielle à Roue and the Spanish Zamfonia. In Ukraine, a variety called Lira was widely used by blind street musicians, most of whom were actually purged by Stalin during the 1930s. But the hurdy-gurdy tradition is still well-developed, particularly in Hungary, Poland, Belarus, southeastern France, and the Ukraine. In the Ukraine, like I just said, is known as the Lira or Relia. It was and still is played by professional, often blind, itinerant musicians, often known as Lerniki. Their repertoire has mostly para-religious themes, and most of it originated in the Baroque period. In eastern Ukraine, the repertoire includes unique historical epics known as Dumi and folk dances. Lerniki were characterized as beggars by the Russian authorities and fell under harsh repressive measures if they were caught performing in the streets of major cities up until 1902, when the authorities were asked by ethnographers attending the 12th All-Russian Archaeological Conference to stop persecuting them. The hurdy-gurdy is the instrument in Dalayaman, I think it's actually pronounced, a street musician portrayed in the last melancholy song of Schubert's Winterreise. It's also featured and played prominently in the film Captain's Courageous, came out in 1937, as the instrument of the character Manuel, played by Spencer Tracy. The instrument came into a new public consciousness when the folk rock troubadour Donovan released his hit pop song Hurdy Gurdy Man in 1968. On a personal note, that's one of my favorite songs of that era. Is creepy and haunting in the best possible way. Give it a listen if you haven't already. It's an amazing song. So, while the song itself does not use a hurdy-gurdy, the repeated references to the instrument in the song's lyrics sparked curiosity and interest among the young generation, eventually resulting in an annual hurdy-gurdy music festival on the Olympic Peninsula area of the state of Washington State in the U.S. each September. Now, today, the tradition has actually resurfaced. Revivals have been underway for many years as well in countries such as Austria, Belarus, Belgium, Czech Republic, Denmark, Hungary, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, Norway, Poland, Portugal, Russia, Slovakia, Spain, Sweden, and the Ukraine. As the instrument has been revived, musicians have been using it in a variety of different styles, including contemporary forms not typically associated with it. Now, if you want to know what the hurdy-gurdy sounds like, look up the band Lyre. It's spelled L-Y-R-R-E. That's Lima, Y-Frame, Romeo Echo. I've talked about them in the episode Metal or Revised History, and for good reason. They're one of my all-time favorite bands. They're a power metal band from Poland, and their lead singer and frontwoman is also the lead musician for the band, playing a hurdy-gurdy. And honestly, she's incredible. Like, her skill on the hurdy-gurdy is nearly unmatched. And if I was to recommend any of their songs, it'd be Divide and Conquer or Call in the Wind. But realistically, their entire discography so far has been absolutely incredible. So if any of the song of theirs that you like will serve it as an excellent introduction to what hurdy-gurdy actually sounds like. And I really hope you enjoy them. So next up, we have the balalaika. The balalaika is a Russian stringed musical instrument with a characteristic triangular wooden hollow body, a fretted neck, and three strings. Two strings are usually tuned to the same note, and the third string is a perfect fourth higher. That means that it's like roughly a fourth, four notes of scale higher. Generally speaking, with guitars, it's a five. So just so you know. The high-pitched balalaikas are used to play melodies and chords, and the instrument generally has a short sustain, necessitating rapid strumming or plucking when it's used to play melodies. Balalaikas are often used for Russian folk music and dancing. Now, the balalaika family includes instruments of various sizes, from the highest pitch to the lowest. You've got the piccolo balalaika, the prima balalaika, secunda, alto, bass, and finally we come to the contrabass. There are balalaika orchestras that consist solely of different balalaikas. These ensembles typically play classical music that's been arranged for the instrument. The prima balalaika is the most common. The piccolo is the most rare. There have also been descant and tenor balalaikas, but these are considered obsolete. Every balalaika will have three side bodies. They're made of spruce, evergreen, or fir tops. And the backs are made of 3 to 9 wooden sections, usually made of maple. The prima, secunda, and alto balalaikas are played either with the fingers or with a plectrum, aka a pick, depending on what kind of music is being played. And the bass and contrabass balalaikas, which are equipped with extension legs that rest on the floor, are played with leather picks. The rare piccolo instrument is also usually played with a pick. The earliest mention of the term balalaika actually dates back to a 1688 Russian document. Another appearance of the word is registered to a document from the, I'm probably going to butcher this, Verkhoturski district of Russia, dating October 1700. It's also mentioned in a document dated 1714 and signed by the Russian Tsar Peter the Great regarding the welling celebrations of Enemzotov in St. Petersburg. In the Ukrainian language, the word was first documented in the 18th century as balabaika. This form is also present in South Russian dialects and the Belarusian language, as well as in Siberian Russia. It made its way into literature and first appeared in Elysie, which is a 1771 poem by V. Makov. Balalaika also appears in Nikolai Gogol's Dead Souls, written somewhere between 1837 and 1842. Now, from a cultural point of view, more recently, it has a pretty serious emphasis in the Soviet system. See, when the Soviet system came to power, the entrenchment of the proletarian cultural division and direction, the culture of the working classes, which included that of village laborers, was actively supported by the Soviet establishment. The concept of the balalaika orchestra was adopted wholeheartedly by the Soviet government as something distinctly working class, and it was also deemed quite progressive for its time. Significant amounts of effort, time, and energy were devoted to support and foster the formal study of the balalaika, from which emerged highly, highly skilled ensemble groups, such as the Osipov State Russian Folk Orchestra. Balalaika virtuosos such as, I'm probably going to butcher his name, Boris Feoktistov and Pavel Necheporenko, became stars both inside and outside the Soviet Union, and the movement for balalaika orchestras was so powerful that even the renowned Red Army Choir, which initially used a normal symphonic orchestra, changed its instrumentation, replacing violins, violas, and violoncellos with orchestral balalaikas and dominos. Now, during the 20th century, interest in Russian folk music instruments grew outside of Russia, likely as a result of Western tours by Andreev and other balalaika virtuosos early in the century. Significant balalaika associations are to be found in Washington, D.C., L.A., New York, Atlanta, and Seattle. And for example, you have Ian Anderson plays the balalaika on two songs from Jethro Tull's 1969 album Stand Up. You've got Jeffrey Goes to Leicester Square and the song Fat Man. Both play balalaika on that. Wes Anderson, who I personally cannot stand his films, but that's beside the point, Wes Anderson's 2014 film The Grand Budapest Hotel, which actually won the Academy Award for Best Original Score for that year, employs many balalaikas in both Alexandre Desplat's original score and several soundtrack recordings by the Osipov State Russian Folk Orchestra. Oleg Burnov of the Russian-American rock band The Red Elvises played a red electrified contrabass balalaika during the band's North American tours. Deha Sandoval currently tours with The Red Elvises and plays a bass balalaika. Now, this next one, for me, is actually really cool. Kate Bush featured the balalaika played by her brother Patty Bush in two of her big singles. She got Babushka, and this one really surprised me, Running Up That Hill. Now, I am a massive fan of that song. I did not know that song had the balalaika until I was researching this episode. And I'm really psyched to show you guys that because, to be honest, like, if you're like me, you probably heard that song a bit of a while back. Like, it was very famously featured on Strange Things. My first introduction of it was actually through the show Bones, which I only watched up until season 5. Apparently after that, it got soap opera-ish. But there was a cover of that, and so that's where I learned about Kate Bush in the original version. I did not know the balalaika was in that song. That's seriously cool. All right, so next up we have Katzenjammer, the Norwegian orgel pop band. They use two controversial balalaikas, both of which have cat faces painted on the front. They're named Børje and Akerø. Now, David Lean's 1965 film Dr. Zhivago features balalaika prominently in the score and in the plot. Volgograd, which is an Australian band fronted by the actor Jacek Koman, plays songs from the Russian criminal underground and uses a contrabass balalaika. I do not know if they're any good. I've never heard of them before, so make up your own mind. You got Rebisol, plays a balalaika on numerous songs on the Rebisol albums Fringe of Blue, Rebisol O, Change the World with the Sound, and From Another World. He also plays a balalaika on the Common Tongue album Step Into My Word and on the Shlomit and Rebisol album The Seal of Solomon. The instrument is actually very heavily featured in the episode The Secret War of the Netflix series Love, Death, and Robots. The instrument's also used alongside a piano and a banyan, a type of Russian accordion, in the piece A Journey from the soundtrack to the 2013 Japanese animated film The Wind Rises. Selo Iludi, a Ukrainian folk band, utilizes a balalaika. The instrument makes a brief appearance in the Charlie Chaplin film from 1931, City Lights. The Beatles song Back in the USSR includes a lyric, Let Me Hear Your Balalaikas Ringing Out. Now, regardless of my own personal opinions about the Beatles, I had to say that one. The song Winds of Change by Scorpions includes the lyric, Let Your Balalaika Sing What My Guitar Wants to Say. One of my personal favorite films, the 2000 crime comedy film Snatch, directed by Guy Ritchie, who's one of my favorite directors, features the balalaika being heavily played in the theme to Boris the Blade's character. If you haven't seen any Guy Ritchie's films, look him up. He directed the Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock Holmes movies. He did The Man from U.N.C.L.E. He did Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, King Arthur, Legend of the Sword. He's an amazingly talented director who doesn't get enough love. And I for one, at the point of this recording, this film has not yet come out. I'm really looking forward to his film, The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. So I'm really looking forward to that. But like I said, as of this recording, that film has not yet come out. When it does, I'll actually be doing an episode on the Special Operations Executive during World War II. So stay tuned for that one. And finally, the balalaika is actually featured in the soundtrack to the 2017 film Furious from the Fast and the Furious franchise. So, moving from Europe to the New World, we have the Aztec Death Whistle. Now, like I said, I speak a tiny bit of Nahuatl, so I'm probably going to butcher this pronunciation, but bear with me. The Aztec Death Whistle, otherwise known as the Ehecatchitli in Nahuatl. Sorry, I studied the Aztecs and the Mayans, but I don't actually speak any Nahuatl. I speak Spanish, I don't speak Nahuatl, so my pronunciation of that is probably really bad. It was a whistle used by the Mexica people, better known to the modern world as the Aztecs. The whistle was actually discovered following the 1999 excavation of an Aztec temple at the Tlatelolco site in Mexico City by archaeologists, revealing the remains of a 20-year-old sacrificial victim clutching various musical instruments, among them a small ceramic skull-shaped whistle. This artifact, later dubbed the Aztec Death Whistle, garnered public interest. The whistle sounds, analyzed for its functioning mechanism, have been noted to resemble the sound of the wind and fall within the human hearing sensitivity range. Experimental models of death whistles have been constructed and tested to explore hypotheses and for use in conferences and demonstrations, given that the original ancient resonators cannot be utilized for these purposes. A common misconception is that the whistle produces a sharp, shriek-like sound. However, these sounds created as the Aztec Death Whistle are actually produced by much larger reproductions of the whistle. A music archaeologist called Adia Both, who has tested the original excavated whistles, reports the actual sound produced is far softer, being described as similar to, quote, the atmospheric noise generated by the wind, end quote. The skeleton was actually unearthed within a temple devoted to the wind god Ehecatl, providing speculation that among scholars that the whistles were intended to mimic the sound of the wind. Now, this could be that because summoning a strong wind at will, as was required in rituals and ceremonies, may not have been feasible. The only known reference to the potential ancient use of this type of whistle comes from this excerpt from Lewis Spencer's 1913 book Myths of Mexico and Peru, and I quote, "The most remarkable festival in connection with Tezcatlipoca is the Toxcatl, held on the fifth month. On the day of this festival, a youth was slain for whom the entire year previously had been carefully reconstructed as a role of victim. He assumed the name, garb, and attributes of Tezcatlipoca himself as the earthly representative of the deity. He carried also a whistle symbolical of the deity as Lord of the Night Wind, and made with it a noise such as the weird wind of the night makes when it hurries through the streets." End quote. Now that's pretty cool. That being said, we don't know if that's actually accurate because, like I said, that book is from 1913. It's not from the Aztec period. We don't know. So it's the only written record we have of it in anywhere near the historical context. And even then, that's roughly just over 100 years ago, right? The Aztecs were over 500 years ago by now. So yeah, do with that what you will. Now, the idea has been popularized among popular culture that hundreds of warriors would use the whistles at the same time. However, there is actually limited evidence to support this claim. Music archaeologists suggest that the purpose of the whistle, based on its location at the base of a temple, its imagery related to death, and the lack of whistles ever discovered at battle sites or warrior graves, was far more likely to be ceremonial or religious rather than in useful warfare. However, the actual symbolic purpose and real use of the whistle requires furthering investigation. It is currently mostly just speculation. That being said, I know that I said that the ones that you hear nowadays aren't what's indicative of the ancient ones, but I would still look them up on YouTube because they are terrifying to hear. They are honestly some of the creepiest sounds I've ever heard in my life, and I've heard a lot of creepy stuff. So yeah, look them up on YouTube. They are absolutely terrifying to listen to. Do not listen to it at night. Just trust me on that. Now, moving from Mexico to Mongolia, we have the Tovshur. Like I said, I don't speak Mongolian, so I'm probably going to pronounce that wrong. The Tovshur, also known as the Topshur or Topshur, is a two or three string lute played by the Western Mongolian, the Oirats tribe, and called the Altai Uriangais, I think I pronounced right, the Altais, the Tuvans, and the Khalkha peoples. The Topshur is closely tied to the folklore of Western Mongolian people and is accompanied by the performances of storytellers, singing, and dancing. According to descriptions given by Marco Polo, the Mongols also play the instruments before battle. All Topshur are homemade, and because of this, the materials and shape of the Topshur vary depending on the builder and region. For example, depending on the tribe, the string might be made from horsehair or sheep intestine. The body of the Topshur is usually bowl-shaped, and is usually, but not always, covered in tight animal skin. The Kalmykian Topshur's form is actually quite similar to that of the Kazakh Dombra. Now, I'm going to be talking more about that and why I want to include this in this episode at the end of the next instrument. So, the next instrument we want to talk about, the last one for today, is the Morenhur. The Morenhur, otherwise known as the horsehead fiddle, is a traditional Mongolian bowed stringed instrument. It's actually one of the most important musical instruments to the Mongol people, and is considered a symbol of the nation of Mongolia. It's classified as a, quote, masterpiece of the oral and intangible heritage of humanity, which is actually identified by UNESCO. They're the ones who decide what is important for humanity. So for an instrument to be placed that highly, that is an insanely high praise. Now, the full classical name in Mongolian, I can't pronounce because, like I said, I don't speak Mongolian, but it translates in English as fiddle with a horse's head. In Western Mongolia, it's known as an ikil, which can't be confused with an instrument called an igil, which has a G in it, whereas in Eastern Mongolia, it's known as a shur. The instrument itself consists of a trapezoid formed wooden frame soundbox to which two strings are attached. It's held nearly upright with the soundbox in the musician's lap or between the musician's legs. The strings are made from hair from nylon or from horses' tails, strung parallel and run over a wooden bridge on the body up a long neck, past a second smaller bridge to the two tuning pegs in the scroll, which is usually carved in the form of a horse's head. The bow is loosely strung with horsehair coated with larch or cedarwood resin and is held from underneath by the right hand. The underhand grip enables the hand to tighten the loose hair on the bow, allowing some very fine control of the instrument's timbre. Now, the larger of the two strings, the male string, has 130 hairs traditionally from a stallion's tail, whereas the female string has 105 hairs from a mare's tail. Nowadays, the strings are actually made of nylon, but traditionally they were tuned a fifth apart, though in modern music they are more often tuned a fourth apart, usually to B flat and F. The strings themselves are stopped either by pinching them in the joints of the middle index fingers, or by pinching them between the nail of the middle finger and the pad of the ring finger. Traditionally, the frame is covered by animal skin, such as camel, goat, or sheepskin, in which case a small opening would be left in the back. However, since the 1970s, new completely wooden sound box instruments have appeared with carved F-holes similar to European stringed instruments. The modern standard height is 1.15 meters, 3 foot 9 inches. The distance between the upper bridge and lower bridge is about 60 centimeters, 24 inches, or 2 feet. But the upper bridge especially can be adapted to match smaller players' fingers. The sound box usually has a depth of 8 to 9 centimeters, roughly 3 to 3.5 inches. And the width of the sound box is about 20 centimeters at the top, that's nearly 8 inches, and 25 centimeters, nearly 10 inches, at the bottom. Good quality instruments can actually achieve a strength of 85 decibels, which is a very, very loud instrument, which allows it to be played, if desired, even in mezzo forte or crescendo. When horsehair is used, luthiers prefer to use the horsehair of white stallions. In general, the quality of a horsehair string depends on its preparation, the climate conditions, and the nutrition of the animals. This gives a wide area for quality differences. Quality nylon strings tend to last for up to 2 years, but only if prepared and placed correctly on the instrument. Most beginners don't comb the strings, and so the sound quality worsens quite quickly. Good strings nearly sound like steel strings, and in spectrograms they show about 7 to 8 harmonics. Modern hur vary in form depending on the region. Instruments from Central Mongolia tend to have larger bodies and thus possess more volume than the smaller bodied instruments of Inner Mongolia. In addition, the Inner Mongolian instruments have got mostly mechanics for tightening strings, where Mongolian luthiers mainly use the wooden pegs in a slight conic shape. One legend about the origin of the modern hur is a shepherd called Namjil the Cuckoo, or Huhu Namjil, received the gift of a flying horse. He would mount it at night and fly to meet his beloved. A jealous woman had the horse's wings cut off so that the horse fell from the air and died. The grieving shepherd made a horse head fiddle from the now wingless horse's skin and tail hair and used it to play poignant songs about his horse. Another legend credits the invention of the morning hur to a boy called Suhe or Suho. After a wicked lord slew the boy's prized white horse, the horse's spirit came to Suhe in a dream and instructed him to make an instrument from the horse's body so that the two could be together and neither would be lonely. So the first morning hood was assembled with horse bones as its neck, the horse hair strings, horse skin covering its wooden soundbox, and a scroll carved in the shape of a horse's head. Now the fact that most of the eastern Turkic neighbors of the Mongols possess similar horsehair instruments, such as the Tuvan Igil, which I mentioned earlier, the Kazakh Kobis, or the Kyrgyz Kilkiyak, I also don't know how to pronounce that, though not western Turkic, may point to a possible origin among peoples that once inhabited the Mongolian steppes and migrated to what is now Tuva, Kazakhstan, and Kyrgyzstan. The Gusle, otherwise known as Lahuta, from southeastern Europe, in countries of Serbia, Croatia, and Albania, is a very, very similar instrument and may indicate that this is actually an extremely ancient musical instrument, potentially even dating back to the outward migration of people out of the Middle East and Central Asia some 40,000 years ago. Often these instruments are depicted with a goat head instead of a horse in Europe. The modern hur is actually the national instrument of Mongolia, and many festivals are held celebrating the importance of this instrument on Mongolian culture, such as the biannual International Modern Hur Festival and Competition, which is organized by the World Modern Hur Association. First held in 2008, second in 2010, with 8 participating countries, Mongolia, Korea, China, Russia, USA, Germany, France, and Japan. And another plan, it was planned for 2012, and apparently it's still been coming along since then. Here, many amateurs come and try to play freestyle pieces, but there's also professional contests being held and an instrument-making competition. During June, the Roaring Hooves Festival is held. This is a small festival for professional skill players, but unfortunately is closed to the public. The recordings from this festival are often shown on TV reports later. On the national festival, Nardam, praise songs for the most magnificent horse and for the most highly skilled wrestler and archer are played. These songs are called Magtal and are accompanied by a unique style of praise and monohur. Many Mongolians actually will have the instrument in their home because it's a symbol for peace and happiness. And finally, we come to the reason I wanted to talk about Mongolian instruments. A number of folk metal and folk rock bands from Mongolia and the Chinese Autonomous Region of Inner Mongolia have combined heavy metal and rock music with traditional Mongolian lyrical themes and instruments, including the modern hur. Some of these bands include Altan Urag, Nine Treasures, Tenger Cavalry, Hangai, and Uhai. Now, the reason I want to talk specifically about the Topshur and the Morning Horde is because of the band The Who, spelled H-U. They're one of my all-time favorite folk metal bands, and fun fact, they're actually canonically part of the Star Wars universe. No, seriously. The Who's music is actually used in two video games in the Star Wars universe, Star Wars Jedi Fallen Order, which released in 2019, and Star Wars Jedi Survivor, which was released last year in 2023. Several of these songs can be actually had throughout gameplay performed by the in-game band the Agasar. Now, these are actually played by The Who. These include Hohochu, Sugan Esena, otherwise translated as Black Thunder, and Esirin Vasahina. In an interview with Revolver magazine in 2020, the frontman for The Who, Gala Tsendbatad, is quoted as saying, "We were all fans of Star Wars beforehand. We started watching the movies at such young ages and all wanted to be like Luke Skywalker. And the character of Luke gave us desire to be strong, honest men." The lyrics for Sugan Esena were actually originally drafted in Mongolian and performed during live shows in Europe and North America. Following tour dates, the lyrics are rewritten into the Huttese language for use in the game. Now, Huttese is a language that Jabba the Hutt speaks, it's a language that Greedo speaks, is commonly spoken in the Star Wars universe as a alternative to Basic, Galactic Basic, which is, in other words, English. Gala has claimed that the band would love to perform Sugan Esena in the Star Wars language that they created, but it would be too difficult. Now, if I was actually to recommend any of the Who songs to you, I'd start with Wolf Totem in the original Mongolian and explore outwards from there, because they've done collabs with English-speaking artists as covers of some of their songs. I would personally recommend listening to the original in Mongolian so you get a taste for it, and then if you like that, work your way outwards. Because, honestly, these guys have a really unique style. They use throat singing, they use traditional Mongolian instruments that have been electrified. They are absolutely incredible musicians. So I would highly recommend them as, if you're after something a bit weird, give them a listen. They are absolutely outstanding. Anyway, that's all for today, folks. Thanks for listening to Ravensgrove. I'm Adahi. You've been awesome. I'll talk in the next episode. See ya.